notice the Commerce Bank building on the skyline. There's a law in Germany prohibiting buildings higher than 20 stories, but Frankfurt allows exceptions. The Commerce Bank Tower is 53 stories high and unusually shaped. It resembles a giant throne. The top of the building, the arms of the throne, are more decorative than useful. The interesting thing, said the German financier, who visited often, is the glass room at the top, from which one looks down over Frankfurt. It is a men's toilet. Commerce Bank executives had taken him there to show him how, in full view of the world below, he could shit on Deutsche Bank. The Commerce Bank chairman, Klaus-Peter Müller, actually works in Berlin, inside another very German kind of place. His office is attached to the side of the Brandenburg Gate. The Berlin Wall once ran, roughly speaking, right through the middle of it. One side of his building was once a field of fire for East German border guards, the other a backdrop for Ronald Reagan's famous speech, "Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." From looking at it, you would never guess any of this. "After the wall came down, we were offered the chance to buy it back," says Müller. "This building had been ours before the war, but the condition was that we had to put everything back exactly the way it was. It all had to be hand-fabricated." He points out the seemingly antique brass doorknobs and the seemingly antique windows. Across Germany in the past 20 years or so, town centers completely destroyed by bombs in World War II have been restored stone by stone. The German government has agreed to pay some huge sum of money to rebuild the Berliner Schloss, the old royal palace that was leveled in the 1950s by the East German authorities, so that it will look exactly as it does in pre-war photographs. If the trend continues, it will one day appear as if nothing terrible had ever happened in Germany, when everything terrible happened in it. "Do not ask me what it cost," the bank chairman says, and laughs. He then offers me the same survey of German banking that I will hear from half a dozen others. German banks are not, like American banks, mainly private enterprises. Most are either explicitly state-backed or small savings co-ops. Commerce Bank, Dresdner Bank, and Deutsche Bank, all founded in the 1870s, are the only three big private German banks. In 2009, Commerce Bank bought Dresdner. Both turned out to be loaded with toxic assets, and so the merged bank required a government bailout. "We are not a proprietary trading nation," says Müller, getting pretty quickly to the nub of Germany's banking problems. German banking was never meant to be a high-stakes affair. Banking, done in the proper German fashion, is less a free enterprise than a utility. "Why should you pay $20 million to a 32-year-old trader?" Müller asks himself. He uses the office space, the IT, the business card with a first-class name on it. If I take the business card away from that guy, he would probably sell hot dogs. This man is the German equivalent of the head of Bank of America or Citigroup, and he is actively hostile to the idea that bankers should make huge sums of money. In the bargain, he tells me why the current financial crisis has so unsettled the German bankers' view of the financial universe. In the early 1970s, after he started at Commerce Bank, the bank opened the first New York branch of any German bank, and he went to work in it. He mists up a bit when he tells stories about the Americans he did business with back then. In one story, an American investment banker who had inadvertently shut him out of a deal hunts him down and hands him an envelope with $75,000 in it, because he hadn't meant for the German bank to get stiffed. "You have to understand," he says emphatically, "this is where I get my view of Americans." In the past few years, he adds, that view had changed. I sense a feeling of loss. "How much money did you lose in subprime?" I ask. I don't want to tell you, he says. He laughs and then continues. For 40 years, we didn't lose a penny on anything with a AAA rating, he says. We stopped building the portfolio in subprime in 2006. I had the idea that there was something wrong with your market. I did not have the idea that your market would completely collapse. He pauses. It has told something to me. I was in the belief that the best supervised of all banking systems was in New York. To me, the Fed and the SEC were second to none. I did not believe that there would be email traffic between investment bankers saying that they were selling... He pauses again and decides he shouldn't say shit. Dirt, he says. This is by far my biggest professional disappointment. I was in a much too positive way U.S. biased. I had a set of beliefs about U.S. values. The global financial system may exist to bring borrowers and lenders together, but over the past few decades it has become something else too. A tool for maximizing the number of encounters between the strong and the weak, so that the one might exploit the other. Extremely smart traders inside Wall Street investment banks devise deeply unfair, diabolically complicated bets, and then send their sales forces out to scour the world for some idiot who will take the other side of those bets. During the boom years, a wildly disproportionate number of those idiots were in Germany. As a reporter for Bloomberg News in Frankfurt named Aaron Kirchfeld put it to me, you'd talk to a New York investment banker and they'd say, no one is going to buy this crap. Oh, wait, the Landes banks will? When Morgan Stanley designed extremely complicated credit default swaps so they were all but certain to fail, so that their own proprietary traders could bet against them, the buyer was German. When Goldman Sachs helped the New York hedge fund manager John Paulson design a bond to bet against, a bond that Paulson hoped would fail, the buyer on the other side was a German bank called IKB. IKB, along with another famous fool at the Wall Street poker table called West LB, was based in Dusseldorf. Which is why when you asked a smart Wall Street subprime mortgage bond trader circa June 2007 who was still buying his crap, he could say simply, stupid Germans in Dusseldorf. The drive from Berlin to Dusseldorf takes longer than it should. For long stretches, the highway is choked with cars and trucks. A German traffic jam is a peculiar sight. No one honks. No one switches lanes searching for some small, illusory advantage. All trucks remain in the right-hand lane, where they are required to be. The spectacle of sparkling BMWs and Mercedes-Benzes in the left lane and immaculate trucks in a neat row in the right lane is almost a pleasure to watch. Because everyone in the jam obeys the rules and believes that everyone else will obey them too, the cars and trucks move as fast as they can, given the circumstances. But the pretty young German woman behind the wheel of our car doesn't take any pleasure in it. Charlotta huffs and groans at the sight of brake lights stretching into the distance. It's what I hate more than anything in the world, she says apologetically. I hate being stuck in traffic. She pulls from her bag the German translation of Alan Dundee's book. I'd asked her about the title. There is a common German expression, she explains, that translates directly as lick my ass. To this hearty salutation, the common German reply is, you lick mine first. The German version of Dundee is called, you lick mine first. Everyone will understand this title, she says, but this book, I don't know about this. The last time I'd been in Germany for more than a few days was when I was 17 years old. I'd traveled across the country with two friends, a bike, and a German phrase book. In my head was a German love song taught to me by an American woman of German descent. So few people spoke English that it was better to assume they did not, and deploy whatever German came to hand, which usually meant the love song. And so I assumed on this trip I would need an interpreter. I didn't appreciate how much the Germans had been boning up on their English. The entire population seems to have taken a total immersion Berlitz course. And on Planet Money, even in Germany, English is the official language. It's the language used for all meetings inside the European Central Bank, for instance, even though the ECB is in Germany, and the only ECB country in which English is even arguably the native tongue is Ireland. Through a friend of a friend of a friend, I'd landed Charlotta, a sweet-natured, keenly intelligent woman in her 20s, who was also shockingly steely. How many sweet-natured young women can say, "lick my ass," without blushing? She spoke 7 languages, including Mandarin and Polish, and was finishing up her master's in intercultural misunderstanding, which just has to be Europe's next growth industry. By the time I realized I didn't need her, I'd already hired her, and so she had ceased to be my interpreter and become my driver. As my interpreter, she would have been ridiculously overqualified. As my chauffeur, she is frankly preposterous. But she'd taken on the job with gusto, going so far as to hunt down an old German translation of Dundee's little book. And it troubled her. For a start, she refused to believe that there was such a thing as a German national character. "No one in my field believes this anymore," she says. "How do you generalize about 80 million people? You can say they are all the same, but why would they be this way? My question about Germans being anally obsessed is, how would this spread? Where would it come from?" Dundee himself actually made a stab at answering the question. He suggested that the unusual swaddling techniques employed by German mothers, which left babies stewing in their own filth for long periods of time, might be responsible for their energetic anality. Charlotta was not buying it. "I've never heard of this," she says. But just then she spots something and brightens. "Look," she says, "a German flag." Sure enough, a flag flies over a small house in a distant village. You can spend days in Germany without seeing a flag. Germans aren't allowed to cheer for their team the way other people do. That doesn't mean they don't want to, just that they must disguise what they are doing. Patriotism, she says, is still taboo. It's politically incorrect to say, "I'm proud to be German." The traffic eases, and we're once again flying toward Dusseldorf. The highway looks brand new, and she guns the rented BMW until the speedometer tops 210 kilometers per hour. "This is a really good road," I say. "The Nazis built it," she says. "That's what people say about Hitler when they get tired of saying the usual things. Well, at least he built good roads." Back in February 2004, a financial writer in London named Nicholas Dunbar broke the story about some Germans in Dusseldorf working inside a bank called IKB who were up to something new. The name IKB just kept coming up in London with bond salesmen, says Dunbar. It was like everybody's secret cash cow. Inside the big Wall Street firms, there were people whose job it was, when the German customers from Dusseldorf came to London, to get a wad of cash and make sure the Germans got whatever they wanted. Dunbar's piece appeared in Risk magazine and described how this obscure German bank was rapidly turning into Wall Street's biggest customer. IKB had been created back in 1924 to securitize German war reparation payments to the Allies, morphed into a successful lender to mid-sized German companies, and was now morphing into something else. The bank was partially owned by a German state bank, but was not itself guaranteed by the German government. It was a private German financial enterprise, seemingly on the rise. And it had hired a man named Dirk Rotig, a German with some experience in the United States. He'd work for State Street Bank, to do something new and interesting. With Rotig's help, IKB created, in effect, a bank, incorporated in Delaware, and listed on the exchange in Dublin, Ireland, called Rhineland Funding. They didn't call it a bank. If they called it a bank, people might have asked why it was not regulated. They called it a conduit, a word that had the advantage that no one understood what it meant. Rhineland borrowed money for short periods of time by issuing something called commercial paper. They invested it in longer-term structured credit, which turned out to be a euphemism for bonds backed by American consumer loans. Many of the same Wall Street investment banks that raised the money for Rhineland by selling the commercial paper for them sold Rhineland the bonds backed by the American consumer loans. Rhineland's profits came from the difference between the rate of interest it paid on the money it borrowed and the higher rate of interest it earned on the money it lent through its bond purchases. As IKB guaranteed the entire enterprise, Moody's rating service gave Rhineland its highest rating, enabling Rhineland to borrow money cheaply. The Germans in Dusseldorf had one critical job: to advise this offshore vehicle they had created about which bonds it should buy. "We are one of the last to get our money out of Rhineland," Rotig told Risk magazine, "but we're so confident of our ability to advise it in the right way that we still make a profit." Rotig further explained that IKB had invested in special tools to analyze the complicated bonds called collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, that Wall Street was now peddling. "I would say it has proven a worthwhile investment because we have not faced a loss so far," he said. In February 2004, all this seemed like a good idea. So good that lots of other German banks copied IKB and either rented IKB's conduit or set up their own offshore vehicles to buy subprime mortgage bonds. "It sounds like quite a profitable strategy," the man from Moody's, who had awarded Rhineland's commercial paper a AAA rating, told Risk magazine. I met Dirk Rotig for lunch at a restaurant in Dusseldorf on a canal lined with busy shops. From their profitable strategy, IKB has announced losses of roughly $15 billion. Though their actual losses are probably greater, as German banks are slow to declare anything. Rotig viewed himself, with some justice, more as victim than perpetrator. "I left the bank in December 2005, he says quickly, as he squeezes himself into a small booth. Then he explains. The idea for the offshore bank had been his. The German management at IKB had taken to it, as he put it, like a baby takes to candy. He'd created the bank when the market was paying higher returns to bondholders. Rhineland Funding was paid well for the risk it was taking. By the middle of 2005, with the financial markets refusing to see a cloud in the sky, the price of risk had collapsed. The returns on the bonds backed by American consumer loans had collapsed. Rotig says he went to his superiors and argued that as they were being paid a lot less to take the risk of these bonds, IKB should look elsewhere for profits. But they had a profit target and they wanted to meet it. To make the same profit with a lower risk spread, they simply had to buy more, he says. The management, he adds, did not want to hear his message. I showed them the market was turning, he says. I was taking the candy away from the baby instead of giving it. So I became the enemy. When he left, others left with him, and the investment staff was reduced, but the investment activity boomed. One half the number of people, with one third the experience, made twice the number of investments, he says. They were ordered to buy. He goes on to describe what appeared to be a scrupulous and complicated investment strategy, but was actually a mindless, rule-based investment strategy. IKB could value a CDO down to the last basis point, as one admiring observer told Risk magazine in 2004. But in this expertise was a kind of madness. They would be really anal about, say, which subprime originator went into these CDOs, says Nicholas Dunbar. They'd say, we won't take loans from First Franklin, but we will take them from Countrywide. But it didn't matter. They were arguing about bonds that would collapse from 100 par down to 2 or 3% of par. In a sense, they were right. They bought the bonds that went to 3 rather than to 2. As long as the bonds offered up by the Wall Street firms abided by the rules specified by IKB's experts, they got hoovered into the Rhineland funding portfolio without further inspection. Yet the bonds were becoming radically more risky because the loans that underpinned them were becoming crazier and crazier. After he left, Rotig explains, IKB had only 5 investment officers, each in his late 20s, with a couple of years' experience. These were the people on the other end of the bets being handcrafted by Goldman Sachs for its own proprietary trading book and by other big Wall Street firms for extremely clever hedge funds that wanted to bet against the market for subprime bonds. The IKB portfolio went from $10 billion in 2005 to $20 billion in 2007. Rotig says, and it would have gotten bigger if they had had more time to buy. They were still buying when the market crashed. They were on their way to $30 billion. By the middle of 2007, every Wall Street firm, not just Goldman Sachs, realized that the subprime market was collapsing and tried frantically to get out of their positions. The last buyers in the entire world, several people on Wall Street have told me, were these willfully oblivious Germans. That is, the only thing that stopped IKB from losing even more than $15 billion on U.S. subprime loans was that the market ceased to function. Nothing that happened, no fact, no piece of data, was going to alter their approach to investing money. On the surface, the IKB's German bond traders resembled the reckless traders who made similarly stupid bets for Citigroup and Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley. Beneath it, they were playing an entirely different game. The American bond traders may have sunk their firms by turning a blind eye to the risks in the subprime bond market, but they made a fortune for themselves in the bargain and have, for the most part, never been called to account. They were paid to put their firms in jeopardy, and so it is hard to know whether they did it intentionally or not. The German bond traders, on the other hand, had been paid roughly $100,000 a year, with at most another $50,000 bonus. In general, German bankers were paid peanuts to run the risk that sank their banks, which strongly suggests that they really didn't know what they were doing. But, and here is the strange thing, unlike their American counterparts, they are being treated by the German public as crooks. The former CEO of IKB, Stefan Ortseifen, was given a jail term, since suspended, and has been asked by the bank to return his salary, 805,000 euros. Dirk Rotig had enjoyed a ringside seat not only to IKB, but to the behavior of its imitators, the German state-backed banks, the Landesbanks. And in his view, the border created by modern finance between Anglo-American and German bankers was treacherous. The intercultural misunderstandings were quite intense, he says, as he tucks into his lobster. The people in these banks were never spoiled by any Wall Street salesman. Now there is someone with a platinum American Express credit card who can take them to the Grand Prix in Monaco, takes you to all these places. He has no limit. The Landesbanks were the most boring bankers in Germany, so they never got attention like this. And all of a sudden, a very smart guy from Merrill Lynch shows up and starts to pay a lot of attention to you. They thought, oh, he just likes me. He completes the thought. The American salespeople are much smarter than the European ones. They play a role much better. At bottom, he says, the Germans were blind to the possibility that the Americans were playing the game by something other than the official rules. The Germans took the rules at their face value. They looked into the history of AAA-rated bonds and accepted the official story that AAA-rated bonds were completely risk-free. This preternatural love of rules, almost for their own sake, punctuates German finance as it does German life. As it happens, a story had just broken that a German reinsurance company called Munich Re, back in June 2007, or just before the crash, had sponsored a party for its best producers that offered not just chicken dinners and nearest-to-the-pin golf competitions, but a blowout with prostitutes in a public bath. In finance, high or low, this sort of thing is, of course, not unusual. What was striking was how organized the German event was. The company tied white and yellow and red ribbons to the prostitutes to indicate which ones were available to which men. After each sexual encounter, the prostitute received a stamp on her arm to indicate how often she had been used. The Germans didn't just want hookers, they wanted hookers with rules. Perhaps because they were so enamored of the official rules of finance, the Germans proved especially vulnerable to a false idea the rules encouraged, that there is such a thing as a riskless asset. After all, a AAA rating was supposed to mean riskless asset. There is no such thing as a riskless asset. The reason an asset pays a return is that it carries risk. But the idea of the riskless asset, which peaked about late 2006, overran the investment world, and the Germans fell for it the hardest. I'd heard about this, too, from people on Wall Street who had dealt with German bond buyers. "You have to go back to the German mentality," one of them had told me. "They say, I've ticked all the boxes. There is no risk." It was form over substance. You work with Germans, and I can't emphasize this enough, they are not natural risk takers. They are genetically disposed to fucking it up. So long as a bond looked clean on the outside, the Germans allowed it to become as dirty on the inside as Wall Street could make it. The point Rotig wants to stress to me now is that it didn't matter what was on the inside. IKB had to be rescued by a state-owned bank on July 28, 2007. Against capital of roughly $4 billion, it had lost more than $15 billion. As it collapsed, the German media wanted to know how many U.S. subprime bonds these German bankers had gobbled up. IKB's CEO, Stefan Ortseifen, said publicly that IKB owned almost no subprime bonds at all, which is why he's now charged with misleading investors. "He was telling the truth," says Rotig. "He didn't think he owned any subprime." They weren't able to give any correct numbers of the amount of subprime they had because they didn't know. The IKB monitoring systems did not make a distinction between subprime and prime mortgages. And that's why it happened. Back in 2005, Rotig says, he proposed to build a system to track more precisely what loans were behind the complex bonds they were buying from Wall Street firms, but IKB's management didn't want to spend the money. "I told them, you have a portfolio of $20 billion. You are making $200 million a year, and you are denying me $6.5 million? But they didn't want to do it. For the third time in as many days, we cross the border without being able to see it and spend 20 minutes trying to work out if we are in East or West Germany. Charlotta was born and raised in the East German city of Leipzig, but she is no less uncertain than I am about which former country we are in. "You just would not know anymore unless you are told," she says. "They have to put up a sign to mark it." A landscape once scarred by trenches and barbed wire and minefields exhibits not so much as a ripple. On the outside, at least, it's perfectly clean. Somewhere near this former border, we pull off the road into a gas station. It has three pumps in a narrow channel without space to maneuver or to pass. The three drivers filling their gas tanks need to do it together and move along together, for if any one driver dawdles, everyone else must wait. No driver dawdles. The German drivers service their cars with the efficiency of a pit crew. Precisely because the arrangement is so archaic, Charlotta guesses we must still be in West Germany. You would never find this kind of gas station in East Germany, she says. Everything in East Germany is new. She also claims she can guess at sight whether a person, and especially a man, is from the East or the West. West Germans are much prouder. They stand straight. East Germans are more likely to slouch. West Germans think East Germans are lazy. East Germans are the Greeks of Germany, I say. Be careful, she says. From Dusseldorf, we drive to Leipzig, and from Leipzig, we hop a train to Hamburg to find the mud wrestling. Along the way, she humors me by parsing her native tongue for signs of anality. Kackwurst is the term for feces, she says grudgingly. It literally means shit sausage, and it's horrible. When I see sausages, I can't think of anything else. She thinks a moment. Bescheißen, someone shit on you. Klugscheiße, an intelligent shitter. If you have a lot of money, she continues, you are said to shit money. Geldscheißen. She rips a handful of other examples off the top of her head, a little shocked by how fertile is this line of thinking before she says, and if you find yourself in a bad situation, you say, Die Kacke ist am Dampfen. The shit is steaming. She stops and appears to realize she is encouraging a theory of German national character. It's just in the words, she says. Sure it is. It doesn't mean it applies. Outside of Hamburg, we stop for lunch at a farm owned by a man named Wilhelm Noling. A German economist now in his 70s, but with a kick and bite of a much younger man. He has the chiseled features and silver hair of a patrician, but the vocal cords of a bleacher bum. The Greeks want us to pay their lunch, he bellows, as he gives me a tour of his private goat pen. That is why they are rioting in the streets. Bah! Back when the idea of the euro was being bandied about, Noling had been a governor of the Bundesbank. From the moment the discussion turned serious, he has railed against the euro. He'd written one mournful pamphlet called Goodbye to the Deutsche Mark, and another, more declarative pamphlet called The Euro, A Journey to Hell. Together with three other prominent German economists and financial leaders, he had filed a lawsuit still wending its way through the German courts, challenging the euro on constitutional grounds. Just before the Deutsche Mark got scrapped, Noling had argued to the Bundesbank that they should just keep all the notes. I said, don't shred it, he now says with great gusto, leaping out of an armchair in the living room of his farmhouse. I said, pile it all up, put it in a room, in case we need it later. He finds himself stuck. He knows that he is engaged in an exercise futile and pointless. Can you turn this back? He says. We know we can't turn this back. If they say, okay, we were wrong, you were right, what do? That is the $100,000 million question. He thinks he knows what should be done, but doesn't think Germans are capable of doing it. The idea he and his fellow dissident German economists have cooked up is to split the European Union in two for financial purposes. One euro, a kind of second-string currency, would be issued for and used by the deadbeat countries, Greece, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and so on. The first-string euro would be used by the homogeneous countries, the ones you can rely on. He lists these reliable countries: Germany, Austria, Belgium, the Netherlands, Finland, and, he hesitates for a second over this, France. Are you sure the French belong? We discussed this, he says seriously. They decided that for social reasons you couldn't really exclude the French. It was just too awkward. As he presided over the Maastricht Treaty, which created the euro, the French Prime Minister François Mitterrand is rumored to have said privately that yoking Germany to the rest of Europe in this way was sure to lead to imbalances, and the imbalances were certain to lead to some crisis, but by the time the crisis struck, he'd be dead and gone, and others would sort it out. Even if Mitterrand didn't say exactly that, it's a sort of thing he should have said, as he surely thought it. At the time, it was obvious to a lot of people, and not only Bundesbank governors, that these countries did not belong together. But then how did people who seem as intelligent and successful and honest and well-organized as the Germans allow themselves to be drawn into such a mess? In their financial affairs, they had ticked all the little boxes to ensure that the contents of the bigger box were not rotten, and yet ignored the overpowering stench wafting from the big box. Nolling felt the problem had its roots in German national character. We entered Maastricht because they had these rules, he says, as we move off to his kitchen and plates heaped with the white asparagus Germans take such pride in growing. We were talked into this under false pretenses. Germans are, by and large, gullible people. They trust and believe. They like to trust. They like to believe. If the deputy finance minister has a sign on his wall reminding him to see the point of view of others, here is perhaps why. Others do not behave as Germans do. Others lie. In this financial world of deceit, Germans are natives on a protected island who have not been inoculated against the virus carried by visitors. The same instincts that allowed them to trust Wall Street bond salesmen also allowed them to trust the French when they promised there would be no bailouts, and the Greeks when they swore that their budget was balanced. That is one theory. Another is that they trusted so easily because they didn't care enough about the cost of being wrong, as it came with certain benefits. For the Germans, the euro isn't just a currency. It's a device for flushing away the past. It's another Holocaust memorial. The Greeks may have German public opinion polls running against them, but deeper forces run in their favor. In any case, if you are obsessed with cleanliness and order, yet harbor a secret fascination with filth and chaos, you are bound to get into some kind of trouble. There is no such thing as clean without dirt. There is no such thing as purity without impurity. The interest in one implies an interest in the other. The young German woman who had driven me back and forth across Germany exhibits interest in neither, and it's hard to say whether she is an exception or a new rule. Still, she marches dutifully into the world's largest red light district, seeking out a lot of seedy-looking German men to ask them where she might find a female mud wrestling show. Even now, she continues to find new and surprising ways in which Germans find meaning in filth. Scheiße glänzt nicht, wenn man sie poliert. Shit won't shine even if you polish it, she says, as we pass the funky pussy club. Scheißegal. It just means, I don't give a shit. She laughs. That's an oxymoron in Germany, right? The night is young and the Reeperbahn is hopping. It's the closest thing I've seen in Germany to a mob scene. Hawkers lean against sex clubs and sift likely customers from the passing crowds. Women who are almost pretty beckon men who are clearly tempted. We pass several times the same corporate logo of a pair of stick figures engaged in anal sex. Charlotta spots it and remembers that a German band, Rammstein, was arrested in the United States for simulating anal sex on stage while performing a song called Buk Dich, Bend Over. But on she charges, asking old German men where to find the dirt. At length, she finds a definitive answer from a German who has worked here for decades. The last one shut down years ago, he says. It was too expensive.
Part 5. Too Fat to Fly. On August 5, 2011, moments after the U.S. government watched a rating agency lower its credit rating for the first time in American history, the market for U.S. Treasury bonds soared. 4 days later, the interest rates paid by the U.S. government on its new 10-year bonds had fallen to the lowest level on record, 2.04%. The price of gold rose right alongside the price of U.S. Treasury bonds, but the prices of virtually all other stocks and bonds in rich Western countries went into a free fall. The net effect of a major U.S. rating agency saying that the U.S. government was less likely than before to repay its debts was to lower the cost of borrowing for the U.S. government and to raise it for everyone else. This told you a lot of what you needed to know about the ability of the U.S. government to live beyond its means. It had, for the moment, a blank check. The shakier the United States government appeared, up to some faraway point, the more cheaply it would be able to borrow. It wasn't exposed yet to the same vicious cycle that threatened the financial life of European countries. A moment of doubt leads to higher borrowing costs, which leads to greater doubt and even higher borrowing costs, and so on until you become Greece. The fear that the United States might actually not pay back the money it had borrowed was still unreal. On December 19, 2010, the television news program 60 Minutes aired a 13-minute piece about U.S. state and local finances. The correspondent, Steve Croft, interviewed a private Wall Street analyst named Meredith Whitney, who back in 2007 had gone from being obscure to famous when she correctly suggested that Citigroup's losses in U.S. subprime bonds were far bigger than anyone imagined and predicted the bank would be forced to cut its dividend. The 60 Minutes segment noted that U.S. state and local governments faced a collective annual deficit of roughly $500 billion and noted another $1.5 trillion gap between what the governments owed retired workers and the money they had on hand to pay them. Whitney pointed out that even these numbers were unreliable and probably optimistic, as the states did a poor job of providing information about their finances to the public. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie concurred with her and added, "At this point, if it's worse, what's the difference?" The bill owed by American states to retired American workers was so large that it couldn't be paid, whatever the amount. At the end of the piece, Croft asked Whitney what she thought about the ability and willingness of the American states to repay their debts. She didn't see a real risk that the states would default, because the states had the ability to push their problems down to counties and cities. But at these lower levels of government, where American life was lived, she thought there would be serious problems. "You could see 50 to 100 sizable defaults, maybe more," she said. A minute later, Croft returned to her to ask when people should start worrying about a crisis in local finances. "It'll be something to worry about within the next 12 months," she said. That prophecy turned out to be self-fulfilling. People started worrying about U.S. municipal finance the minute the words were out of her mouth. The next day, the municipal bond market tanked. It kept falling right through the next month. It fell so far, and her prediction received so much attention, that money managers who had put clients into municipal bonds felt compelled to hire more people to analyze states and cities to prove her wrong. One of them called it the Meredith Whitney Municipal Bond Analyst Full Employment Act. Inside the financial world, a new literature was born, devoted to persuading readers that Meredith Whitney didn't know what she was talking about. She was vulnerable to the charge. Up until the moment she appeared on 60 Minutes, she had, so far as anyone knew, no experience at all of U.S. municipal finance. Many of the articles attacking her accused her of making a very specific forecast, as many as 100 defaults within a year, that had failed to materialize. Sample Bloomberg News headline, Meredith Whitney loses credibility as muni defaults fall 60%. The whirlwind thrown up by the brief market panic sucked in everyone who was anywhere near municipal finance. The nonpartisan, dispassionate, sober-minded Center on Budget and Policy Priorities in Washington, D.C., even released a statement saying that there was a mistaken impression that drastic and immediate measures are needed to avoid an imminent fiscal meltdown. This was treated in news accounts as a response to Meredith Whitney, as she was the only one in sight who could be accused of having made such a prediction. But that's not at all what she had said. Her words were being misrepresented so that her message might be more easily attacked. She was referring to the complacency of the ratings agencies and investment advisors who say there is nothing to worry about, said a person at 60 Minutes who reviewed the transcripts of the interview for me, to make sure I had heard what I thought I had heard. She says there is something to worry about, and it will be apparent to everyone in the next 12 months. Whatever else she had done, Meredith Whitney had found the pressure point in American finance, the fear that American cities would not pay back the money they had borrowed. The market for municipal bonds, unlike the market for U.S. government bonds, spooked easily. American cities and states were susceptible to the same cycle of doom that had forced Greece to seek help from the International Monetary Fund. All it took to create doubt and raise borrowing costs for states and cities was for a woman with no standing in the municipal bond market to utter a few sentences on television. That was the amazing thing. She had offered nothing to back up her statement. She had written a massive, detailed report on state and local finances, but no one except a handful of her clients had any idea what was in it. If I was a real nasty hedge fund guy, one hedge fund manager put it to me, I'd sit back and say, this is a herd of cattle that can be stampeded. What Meredith Whitney was trying to say was more interesting than what she was accused of saying. She didn't actually care all that much about the municipal bond market or how many cities were likely to go bankrupt. The municipal bond market was a dreary backwater. As she put it, who cares about the stinking muni bond market? The only reason she had stumbled into that market was that she had come to view the U.S. national economy as a collection of regional economies. To understand the regional economies, she had to understand how state and local governments were likely to behave. And to understand this, she needed to understand their finances. Thus, she had spent two unlikely years researching state and local finance. I didn't have a plan to do this, she said. Not one of my clients asked for it. I only looked at this because I needed to understand it myself. How it started was with a question. How can GDP, gross domestic product, estimates be so high when the states that outperformed the U.S. economy during the boom were now underperforming the U.S. economy? And they were 22% of that economy? It was a good question. From 2002 to 2008, the states had piled up debts right alongside their citizens. Their level of indebtedness as a group had almost doubled, and state spending had grown by two-thirds. In that time, they had also systematically underfunded their pension plans and other future liabilities by a total of nearly $1.5 trillion. In response, perhaps, the pension money that they had set aside was invested in even riskier assets. In 1980, only 23% of state pension money had been invested in the stock market. By 2008, the number had risen to 60%. To top it all off, these pension funds were pretty much all assuming they could earn 8% on the money they had to invest, at a time when the Federal Reserve was promising to keep interest rates at zero. Toss in underfunded healthcare plans, a reduction in federal dollars available to the states, and the depression in tax revenues caused by a soft economy, and you were looking at multi-trillion-dollar holes that could only be dealt with in one of two ways: massive cutbacks on public services, or a default. Or both. She thought default unlikely, at least at the state level, because the state could bleed the cities of money to pay off its bonds. The cities were where the pain would be felt most intensely. "The scary thing about state treasurers," she said, "is that they don't know the financial situation in their own municipalities." "How do you know that?" "Because I asked them." All states may have been created equal, but they were equal no longer. The states that had enjoyed the biggest boom were now facing the biggest busts. "How does the United States emerge from the credit crisis?" Whitney asked herself. I was convinced, because the credit crisis had been so different from region to region, that it would emerge with new regional strengths and weaknesses. Companies are more likely to flourish in the stronger states. The individuals will go to where the jobs are. Ultimately, the people will follow the companies. The country, she thought, might organize itself increasingly into zones of financial security and zones of financial crisis. And the more clearly people understood which zones were which, the more friction there would be between the two. "Indiana is going to be like, 'NFW, I'm bailing out New Jersey.'" As more and more people grasped which places had serious financial problems and which did not, the problems would only increase. "Those who have money and can move, do so," Whitney wrote in her report to her Wall Street clients. "Those without money and who cannot move, do not, and ultimately rely more on state and local assistance. It becomes effectively a tragedy of the commons." The point of Meredith Whitney's investigation, in her mind, was not to predict defaults in the municipal bond market. It was to compare the states to each other so that they might be ranked. She wanted to get a sense of who in America was likely to play the role of the Greeks and who the Germans, of who was strong and who weak. In the process, she had, in effect, unearthed America's scariest financial places. "So, what's the scariest state?" I asked her. She only had to think for about 2 seconds. California. At 7 o'clock one summer morning, I pedaled a $5,000 titanium frame mountain bike, rented in anxiety the previous evening, down the Santa Monica Beach Road to the corner where Arnold Schwarzenegger had asked me to meet him. He turned up right on time, driving a black Cadillac SUV with a handful of crappy old jalopy bikes racked to the back. I wore the closest I could find to actual bicycle gear. He wore a green fleece, shorts, and soft beige slipper-like shoes that suggested both a surprising indifference to his own appearance and a security in his own manhood. His hair was still vaguely in a shape left by a pillow, and his eyelids drooped, though he swore he'd been up for an hour and a half reading newspapers. After reading the newspapers, this is what the former governor of California often does: ride his bike for cardio, then hit the weight room. He hauls a bike off the back of the car, hops on, and takes off down an already busy Ocean Avenue. He wears no bike helmet, runs red lights, and rips past do not enter signs without seeming to notice them, and up one-way streets. When he wants to cross three lanes of fast traffic,
He doesn't so much as glance over his shoulder, but just sticks out his hand and follows it, assuming that whatever is behind him will stop. His bike has at least 10 speeds, but he has just 2, 0, and pedaling as fast as he can. Inside half a mile, he's moving fast enough that wind-induced tears course down his cheeks. He's got to be one of the world's most recognizable people, but he doesn't appear to worry that anyone will recognize him, and no one does. It may be that people who get out of bed at dawn to jog and rollerblade and race walk are too interested in what they are doing to break their trance. Or it may be that he's taking them by surprise. He has no entourage, not even a bodyguard. His economic advisor, David Crane, and his media advisor, Adam Mendelsohn, who came along for the ride just because it sounded fun, are now somewhere far behind him. Anyone paying attention would think, that guy might look like Arnold, but it can't possibly be Arnold because Arnold would never be out alone on a bike at 7 in the morning trying to commit suicide. It isn't until he is forced to stop at a red light that he makes meaningful contact with the public. A woman pushing a baby stroller and talking on a cell phone crosses the street right in front of him and does a double take. Oh, my God, she gasps into her phone. It's Bill Clinton. She's not 10 feet away, but she keeps talking to the phone as if the man is unreal. I'm here with Bill Clinton. It's one of those guys who's had a sex scandal, says Arnold, smiling. Wait. Wait, says the woman to her phone. Maybe it's not Bill Clinton. Before she can make a positive identification, the light is green and we're off. His life has been a series of carefully staged experiences. He himself has no staged presentation of it, however. He is fresh, alive, and improvisational. I'm not sure even he knows what he will do next. He's not exactly humble, but then if I had lived the life he's lived, I'm not sure I would be either, though I might try to fake humility more often than he does, which is roughly never. What saves him from self-absorption, aside from a natural curiosity, is a genuine lack of interest in personal reflection. He lives the same way he rides his bike, paying far more attention to what's ahead than what's behind. In office, he kept no journal of any sort. I find it amazing, but he now says he didn't so much as scribble little notes that might later be used to reconstruct his experience and his feelings about it. Why would I do that? He says. It's kind of like you come home and your wife asks you about your day. I've done it once, and I don't want to do it again. What he wanted to do after a long day of being governor, more or less, was to lift weights. We're just a couple of miles in when he zips around a corner and into a narrow alleyway just off Venice Beach. He's humoring me. I've been pestering him about what it was like for him when he first arrived in America back in 1968, with little money, less English, really nothing but his lats, pecs, traps, and abs, for which there was no obvious market. He stops beside a tall brick wall. It surrounds what might once have been an impressive stone house that now just looks old and bleak and empty. The wall is what interests him because he built it 43 years ago, right after he had arrived and started to train on Muscle Beach. Franco Colombo, like Schwarzenegger, a former Mr. Olympia, and I made money this way. In bodybuilding, there was no money. Here we were world champions of this little subculture, and we did this to eat. Franco ran the business. I mix the cement and knock things down with the sledgehammer. Before he stumbled while running downhill with a refrigerator strapped to his back, Colombo was the frontrunner in the 1977 contest for the title of the world's strongest man. So there was some distinction in being hired by his operation, as Schwarzenegger was, to be the muscle. They had a routine. Franco would play the unreliable Italian, Arnold the sober German, before they cut any deal, they'd scream at each other in German in front of the customer until the customer would finally ask what was going on. Arnold would turn to the customer and explain, "Oh, he's Italian, and you know how they are. He wants to charge you more, but I think we can do it cheaply." Schwarzenegger would then name a not-so-cheap price. And the customer, he says now laughing, he would always say, "Arnold, you're such a nice guy, so honest." It was selling, you know. He surveys his handiwork. "It'll be here for 1,000 years, he says, then points out some erosion on the top. "I said to Franco we ought to come back and fix the top, you know, to show it was guaranteed for life." A poor kid from a small village in Austria, the son of a former Nazi, hops on a plane to America, starts out laying bricks, and winds up running the state and becoming one of America's most prominent political leaders. From post to wire, the race takes less than 35 years. I couldn't help but ask the obvious question. If someone had told you when you were building this wall that you would wind up governor of California, what would you have said? "That would be all right," he said, not exactly catching my drift. "As a boy," I said, taking another tack, "did you believe you'd lead something other than an ordinary life?" "Yes," he didn't miss a beat. "Why?"